A daughter mourns her mother's passing with poetry.
When she was home and sleeping downstairs in the hospital bed, I would tuck her in every night and then go upstairs back to my childhood bedroom where I wrote angst-ridden teen poems in a little black and white composition notebook. So it was an interesting full circle, and I would write one poem a night about what I was feeling and experiencing. And then the rest of the poems I wrote after she died.
That's Leslia Newman. We talk with her about her latest book of poetry, I Carry My Mother. Then more poems.
The cat has a name that I gave it. Everyone knows the cat's name is not its name. It is my name for the cat. Sometimes the cat refuses to acknowledge this name, and sometimes the cat plays along with the life I've created for the cat. Sometimes the cat pretends that it doesn't live in a realm different from the one that the cat and I live in together.
That's Martine Bellin reading from her new poetry collection, This Amazing Cage of Light, New and Selected Poems. We hear more poetry from her and talk with her about writing poetry. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Leslia Newman is best known as the author of the groundbreaking children's book, Heather Has Two Mommies. It was the first children's book to portray lesbian families in a positive way and became a runaway bestseller. She went on to write many more books for both kids and adults. But before she became a best-selling author, Newman was a published poet, and she's continued to write and publish poetry throughout her prolific career. Lucky for us, because Leslia Newman has just published a moving book of poems about her mother's last months of life and her death. It's called I Carry My Mother. Newman took care of her mother during that time, and while there was suffering and grief for both mother and daughter, the love between them sustained and nourished them. The poems in her book are simple but powerful testament to that love, and they sustain and nourish the reader, too, especially those of us who have cared for and mourned the passing of our own parents. Leslia Newman is the author of 70 books, including A Letter to Harvey Milk, Nobody's Mother, The Boy Who Cried Fabulous, and Heather Has Two Mommies. She writes about lesbian identity and Jewish identity. A Letter to Harvey Milk has been made into a film and adapted for the stage. I started out by asking Leslia Newman, when did she start writing poetry?
Poetry is my first love. I started writing poetry when I was very young, about 10 or 11 years old, and my first poems were actually published in 17 magazine in 1976. So from a very early age, not only did I take my poetry seriously in terms of the writing, but I knew I wanted to be a published poet. So that's really been the common thread throughout my literary career. I always turn back to poetry in times of joy, sadness, when I don't know what to write, anytime. It's just the most comforting thing for me. It's my home. It's the place I feel most comfortable.
And this is this poetry volume is about your mother, about her last illness, about her dying, really. I Carry My Mother. Your mother said on her deathbed, write me a book so my story lives on. Just don't make me read it until after I'm gone. What were you thinking when she said that?
I was thinking that this is such a gift. It was the last thing she could do to take care of me, as she knew she was going to leave me imminently. She knew I would write about her anyway, and she was giving me permission to do so. And that was very important to me because the book is pretty personal, you know, and it's about her. So to have her blessing was just meant more to me than anything.
And did she know that, I mean, were you already writing some of these poems?
She didn't know that I was writing them, but yes, the first part of the book called The Deal, which is a series of triolets, which is a French form that uses a rhyme scheme and repetition in a certain pattern. When she was home and sleeping downstairs in the hospital bed, I would tuck her in every night and then go upstairs back to my childhood bedroom where I wrote angst-ridden teen poems in a little black and white composition notebook. So it was an interesting full circle. And I would write one poem a night about what I was feeling and experiencing. And then the rest of the poems I wrote after she died.
Yes, and I actually have two stanzas from the deal here. I was going to actually ask you what the form was. Would it be okay if I read those two stanzas, and then I'd like to ask you to comment on them?
Of course.
So this is from the deal, from your book, your latest poetry. Is it your latest poetry volume?
Yes.
I Carry My Mother. My mother won't admit that she's in pain, though now and then she gives a fearful moan. Even when she's sweating from the strain, my mother won't admit that she's in pain. I wonder what she thinks she has to gain from staying strong and stoic as a stone. My mother won't admit that she's in pain, though now and then she gives a fearful moan. Before I go into the second one, talk a little bit about that. What was your mother going through at this time?
My mother had bladder cancer, and at this point it was inoperable, and her tumors would press on various nerves and be very painful for her. She also had COPD and sometimes had trouble breathing, even though she was still on oxygen full-time. But she did never complain, and I'm not sure why she was so stoic, but partly I think she wanted to protect the people around her whom she loved and who loved her, and she didn't want to be a burden and want us to worry. But it was very obvious that she was suffering.
Yeah, and tell us a little bit more about her as a person.
My mom was the smartest person I ever met. She was a New York Times crossword puzzle doer. She would always use all 7 Scrabble tiles and get 50 extra points every game I played with her. She always answered all the questions on Jeopardy. So that was the brainy part of her. She wanted to be a writer. She published 1 short story in her high school literary magazine and never published after that. She was beautiful. She was kind. She loved her family more than anything. She was resourceful. And she was very generous. And she was a big fan and supporter of my writing, and I was always very grateful for that.
And so now here's the second stanza I'd like to read. Not the following one, but another one of the stanzas from The Deal. My mother tells me where she hides her jewels, the diamonds that she wore when just a bride. I'm damned if I will cry. I know the rules. My mother tells me where she hides her jewels. A nurse comes in to ask about her stools. I couldn't make this stuff up if I tried. My mother tells me where she hides her jewels, the diamonds that she wore when just a bride. Say more about this stanza.
Well, one thing my mom forbid me to do was cry in front of her. And I think the reason for that was if I cried, then she would cry, and she didn't know if she'd be able to stop. So my mom was not very demonstrative in that way. She was very demonstrative in other ways. You know, she always told me how much she loved me and all of that. But, you know, once she said to me, she said, "You don't understand. You're saying goodbye to one person. I'm saying goodbye to everybody I know." And that really stayed with me. You know, I never thought about it from the dying person's perspective. So, you know, not that we were in denial that she was dying, but, you know, she really just was not able to go there. And in terms of her jewels, she left me all her jewelry. I'm her only daughter. I have 2 brothers. And the jewelry was very important to her. My parents both grew up very poor and never dreamed that they would be middle class. And so when my dad could afford to buy her a nice piece of jewelry, he would for her birthday or for Valentine's Day, or for their anniversary, and she wanted me to have those things because they meant a great deal to her.
How was that for you to not be able to cry in front of her? And we're talking about during the dying process. I'm sure when you were a kid, you were allowed to cry.
Right. Well, along with this, my mom, whenever I asked her how she was, she said she was fine. And it was very clear she wasn't fine. So I struck a deal with her. I said, I won't cry if you start being honest with me and tell me how you are. So then she would open up more and tell me how she was feeling. So, you know, I made a commitment. So it was important for me to honor that. You know, I gave her my word. So, you know, I cried at night. I cried upstairs. I cried with my spouse. I cried with friends. But I did not cry in front of her.
Your poem, 13 Ways of Looking at My Mother, is more about your relationship, and particularly how, in some ways, you were the daughter who mothered her at this time. So I'd like to read just 6 lines from that poem. I do not know which I dread more, arriving at my mother's house or leaving it, the pain of being with her or the pain of being without her. She's telling me I'm in charge of her fate, while both of my brothers are deemed second rate. As she's born unto death, I will be her midwife, a daughter for all of her life. I argue, I reason, I try as I might, I learn from the best how to put up a fight. My mother and I are no strangers to strife. A daughter's a daughter for all of her life. Now, I could really relate to this poem because, you know, I had a mother who, she was the person I loved above everybody else. And I saw my job as to be her daughter, to be a good daughter to her. And I feel very privileged at having been her daughter, but we had a lot of strife as well. So I don't think that's so unusual between mothers and daughters. Could you talk about kind of how, you know, those two sides of your relationship with your mom?
Well, you know, we didn't always get along. I mean, from the time I was growing up, I was very rebellious. I became a vegetarian. I became a lesbian. I did things that were very different than what my mom's life looked like, and I think there were times when she took that personally. And so we struggled. You know, I struggled to break free and become my own person, and she struggled to let go of her expectations for me, which was to have a life pretty much like hers. So, but she had a near-death experience 10 years before she died. She collapsed on a cruise ship, and I flew out to California and stayed by her bedside until she was able to, she was on life support for 10 days. And when all that was over, she said to me, and I didn't know this until she said it, she said, I always knew that when I needed you, you would be there. And this was at a time, you know, when we were really struggling. So, you know, that meant a lot to me. That despite everything, she knew that our bond was unbreakable.
That's very powerful. You also write about your dad in these poems, Leslie Newman, in this poetry volume, I Carry My Mother. Talk a little bit about him. I mean, one feels so much for him and the suffering that he's going through at the same time. They must have had a very good relationship.
My parents got together when they were very young. My mom was 20, my dad was 21, so they were married for 63 years, and they were both poor kids from Brooklyn who built a life for themselves, you know, raised 3 kids. My dad's an attorney. It was so devastating for him, and it was so hard for me to watch him go through this. It was just so sad, and he has said things to me like, he's never made an adult decision without my mother, which to me says, really, you know, my mom was the boss. In fact, I'm looking right now. I have a coffee cup that says the boss, which was hers, which I inherited. So, you know, imagine your whole life you have this person by your side who's really the one in charge in many ways, and then all of a sudden they're gone. And you've never managed a house before. You know, you've gone off to work and done what needed to be done and provided financially for your family, and then all of a sudden everything else you have to figure out how to do. And that was very difficult for my dad, on top of just the incredible grief. I mean, he is a man with a broken heart, and that hasn't changed since my mom died 3 years ago. I did give him a copy of this book to read. You know, that was important for me. And he said he used up an entire box of tissues reading it, and he thought it was a wonderful tribute to my mom, and he was proud of me. So that was really important.
Wow, what a gift for him, for you to have written this. And what about your brothers? What was their reaction? I mean, your poor brothers who come across here as being, what is the word you use?
Well, I did use second rate, but, yeah. You know, that's obviously in context in terms of, you know, my mom just really, and, I just think mothers and daughters, there's, I don't want to generalize. In my family, there was a comfort between my mother and me. I mean, you know, when someone is ill, there's a lot to do with the ill person's body that my mother was not comfortable having my brothers do. So, you know, that kind of thing. But my brothers were very moved. You know, they have read other books of my poetry, in particular October Morning, a song from Matthew Shepard. You know, and they're also very supportive of my work.
Yeah, this is, this is your experience and very personal, but it's also very universal, I think, of course, for those of us who are, you know, I guess we're both baby boomers, and now our parents are on their way out, and also what that brings up for us in terms of how we look forward or not to our own death. I'm just wondering, how did your mother's process of going through illness, the final illness and death, what did that do for you in terms of thinking of your own life and death?
Well, it taught me a lot. You know, I observed how she remained in charge throughout the entire process. She made definite, deliberate decisions, some of which other people didn't think were the best decisions, but they were the best decisions for her. And she kept her dignity throughout, and it made me actually less afraid because, you know, I'm very much like my mother, and I feel sometimes even if I'm going through something that's really minute in comparison, I just think if my mom could go through what she went through, I can go through this, whatever it is. And, you know, none of us get out of this alive, and my mother actually is not the first person that I've been through a death experience with. So every time I see someone die, I don't know, it's I feel people pick the people who are around them at that time in their life on some level. It's always a great honor. And I just feel less afraid because there's a lot more people I know on the other side now. And it just seems like a very natural process.
Do you feel like you might see her again when you go on the other side?
Just don't know the answer to that question. Once in a while, I dream about her, and that always makes me really happy.
Right. That was also in one of the poems, and that really struck me because, you know, I had that kind of experience also after my mother died. I dreamed about her a lot. And then on her birthday, on the one-year anniversary of her death, not the one-year anniversary, it was on her birthday, but she actually died not long. So it was 9 months from the date of her death. On her birthday, I had a dream that was, I'd like to share with you and with my listeners, because as I said before, my mother and I had a very strong relationship, both for positive and it was very difficult at times. And there was a lot I felt guilty about, you know, after she died, that I felt like, oh, I should have done this, and why didn't I do that? And she came to me in this dream. We ran towards each other and embraced each other with such pure and simple love. And there was none of the resentment or the anxiety or the guilt, you know, that had kind of beset our relationship during life. And it was such a healing experience. I really felt that she had actually come to me in that dream.
What a beautiful experience, and what a gift you had.
Yeah. Yeah, that really was. And these were all thoughts that came up as I was reading your wonderful poetry volume, Leslie Newman, I Carry My Mother. There's a poem I wonder if you could read. It's about your mother preparing to go, and the poem is Safe Passage.
Safe Passage. My mother is preparing to depart and will soon set sail without me. Standing at sea, I keep a close watch As the gangplank is lowered, the whistle is blasted, the all aboard is called, and my father steers my mother by the elbow, his spindly legs unsteady, his scrawny arm slung across her shoulder, which is anchored by the sea-green oxygen tank that hangs there heavy as a bag of wet sand. On deck now, my mother leans against the rail as she leaves us in her wake, growing smaller and smaller, waving goodbye one last time, her fingers fluttering in the wind like a sail. My father beside me, waving back, his hand opening and closing like a beacon. All is well, all is well. And as we slowly start to drift apart and she journeys toward a new horizon, I stand ashore, one hand holding onto my hat, the other waving for all I am worth. And though I am buoyed by her love, which floats between us like a lifeline, when she disappears, I taste salt, I come unmoored, the waves knock me down.
It's said so beautifully there, but say more about how you processed her passing, just in the days after that happened.
Well, in the days after, there's a lot of things to do. So, there were tasks to be done. There was the funeral home to go to. There was food to prepare for the Shiva. So there was a lot of busyness, which I think in Judaism is on purpose. But then after the Shiva was over, I stayed with my dad for about 2 weeks because I was worried about him. And, we just spent a lot of time sitting in silence or talking about her or then crying. Then there was no one there to say, you can't cry. Mm-hmm. And doing the New York Times crossword puzzle, which was something really important to her, and she did every day. And I spent a lot of time with her in the last 2 years of her life, and we did them together. So that was a way to feel close to her, was to do the puzzle. And my father, I could tell, got a lot of enjoyment out of watching me do it, though he always said I wasn't as smart as my mother.
Well, so you also write about not being able to ask her about things, after she's gone. I have that experience too. Every so often something will come up and I'll kind of do a little dope slap and say, why didn't I ask her about that before she died? And it's a very peculiar sensation because you're brought up short with that you can never, you cannot, while you're still on this side, cross over to that side.
It is kind of shocking when something like that happens. When my dad gave me my mom's jewelry, I know every piece of jewelry has a story. A trip they were on, or this was for her birthday, or whatever. And she would know every single one. And my dad just doesn't. And so, that's not a huge thing, but, anytime I just have a thought that I want to share with her, or something I want to ask her, it becomes so clear that death is final. That's it. One second she was here, the next second she was gone, and there's no going back.
Although in my dreams, my earlier dreams after she died, she kept on coming back to life. Did you have any dreams like that where she came back to life?
I had a dream, and she was very young and beautiful, and she was all made up. And she said to me, you mean the world to me. And that was such a great dream. I was so happy. I didn't want to wake up.
That's beautiful. I wonder if you could read the title poem.
I carry my mother. I carry my mother wherever I go, her belly, her thighs, her plentiful hips, her milky white skin she called this side of snow, the crease of her brow and the plump of her lips. Her belly, her thighs, her plentiful hips, the curl of her hair and her sharp widow's peak, the crease of her brow and the plump of her lips, the hook of her nose and the curve of her cheek. The curl of her hair and her sharp widow's peak, the dark beauty mark to the left of her chin, the hook of her nose and the curve of her cheek, her delicate wrist, so impossibly thin. The dark beauty mark to the left of her chin, her deep-set brown eyes that at times appeared black, her delicate wrist, so impossibly thin, I stare at the mirror. My mother stares back. Her deep-set brown eyes that at times appeared black, her milky white skin she called this side of snow. I stare at the mirror. My mother stares back. I carry my mother wherever I go.
That's so lovely. And it's iambic pentameter also, isn't it?
It's a pantoum, uh-huh. which is a Malaysian form of poetry that uses every line in the poem two times. And it's four-line stanzas, and the second and fourth line of the previous stanza becomes the first and third line of the subsequent stanza, and the first line of the poem is the same as the last line of the poem. So there's a momentum that builds, and the form is very useful to write about experiences that happen over and over so that the content of repetition and the form of repetition go hand in hand.
I'd like to move on for just in the last minute or two of our interview to ask you a little bit about, I mean, you've written a lot about lesbian identity, gay parenting. When did you write Heather Has Two Mommies? What year was that?
I wrote the book in 1988. A friend and I published it in 1989 because nobody else wanted to publish it. Allison Books took it over in 1990, and then in March of 2015, Candlewick Press reissued it with new illustrations.
So 1988, in the decades since you wrote that book, a lot has changed when it comes to gay parenting, gay rights. Looking back, what are some of your reflections on the changes that have happened that I would say your book was part of making happen?
Well, you know, when I wrote the book, I never dreamed it would have the life that it went on to have. And I have heard from so many lesbians who are so grateful not only for the book to read to their kids, but the book for its place in the world. I mean, it did start a conversation, a pretty volatile conversation at times. But, you know, it made a very strong statement that we are here. Many of us have children. We're a loving families, and we're not going away. And, you know, you need to move over, and you need to accept and respect our families and our kids. And, you know, that has really happened for the most part, especially this year with the federal government recognizing marriage equality. So I never dreamed when I wrote this book that I could be a legally married lesbian and that all these wonderful things would happen.
So what inspired you to write Heather Has Two Mommies?
I wrote it at the request of a lesbian mom who stopped me on the street one day and said, I need a book I can read my daughter that shows a family like ours. So I took her request very seriously because when I was growing up, I didn't have any books that showed a family like mine, namely a Jewish family. So I knew what it meant to always be reading books about families that did things that my family didn't. We didn't celebrate Easter. We didn't have a Christmas tree. And it's very isolating. So as a child, I couldn't articulate my need to see a family like mine in a book. But as an adult, I could do something for this child and the children who have two moms. And so that's what I did. There's nothing I like better than a writing challenge.
And you have done so much to help gay families. And now with this book, I carry my mother... much also to move those of us who are facing the passing on of our own mothers or already faced it. Leslie Newman, I want to thank you so much for this fascinating conversation here on Writer's Voice, and I look forward to talking with you again.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Leslie Newman's poetry volume, I Carry My Mother, is out from Headmistress Press. Go to writersvoice.net to read the title poem and watch the book trailer. Next up, poet Martine Bellin and This Amazing Cage of Light. Stay tuned after the break.
Some bright morning when this life is over, I'll fly away, oh glory, I'll fly away.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. About our next guest, poet Martine Bellin, I'll quote from fellow poet Charles North. Martine Bellin's psychological and linguistic adventures in poetry are unlike anyone else's. Celebrating the instabilities of our experience, her poems maneuver kaleidoscopically between ordinary life and myth or fairy tale, vital human concerns such as identity, and dreamlike atmospheres where nothing stays as it appears for long. Well, that says it far more eloquently than I could. Bellin's new book, This Amazing Cage of Light, is a retrospective collection from 5 of her previous poetry volumes, as well as some new poems. Her work has been informed by such disparate influences as Zen Koan's and the history of the American West. One Full Cycle is about the medieval Japanese novelist Murasaki, who wrote The Tale of Genji. It's called The Tale of Murasaki. Martine Bellin's poetry has appeared in numerous anthologies. She's won the American Academy of Poets Award and is a contributing editor of the literary journal Conjunctions. She's also a librettist on several operas. Martine Bellin, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much.
First, tell us about the title. What is The Amazing Cage of Light?
Well, This Amazing Cage of Light, it comes from an Ikkyu poem. And the poem is, well, Ikkyu is a 17th century, 15th century Buddhist monk poet. And the poem is, we live in this cage of light, an amazing cage, animals, animals without end. And that's a poem that since I read it, and that's a Stephen Berg's translation, and it's from a book called Crow with No Mouth that Copper Canyon published. And since I read that poem, it has lived with me. And in fact, it was the epigraph for my collection Ghosts, and then it's also the epigraph for one of the poems in this book called Pond Animals. And it's kind of a koan poem, you know, a poem that I sit with and sit with and sit with, and it's always changing and transforming. So what is it? I think of it as this dynamic life that we have. We live in this cage of life, you know, in this cage of light. And I think of it as the source of the poetry.
Now, you have been much influenced by Japanese literature, by Japanese culture. And you have a series of poems that very much reference Japanese literature and actually reference Murasaki, who was the author of The Tale of Genji. Tell us first a little bit about Murasaki and The Tale of Genji, and what drew you to create a poetry cycle around that literature?
Tale of Genji, some consider the first novel that had ever been written. It's by a woman, Murasaki Shikibu, though it's not really known that that's her name, but that's what we call her. And one of the characters in her novel has that name, Murasaki. And I started reading poems from the Heian Japanese period, from the early 11th century, 10th century, and also pillow books, writings by women, at a point in Japanese history when art and culture really became aestheticized. And it's somewhat what we think of when we think of Japanese aesthetics. The language, the stylized language, and also the relationship between poetry and prose. We'll have kind of haiban, like basho haiban type writing, where you'll have big narrative prose blocks and then haikus in relationship to that. And somehow, there's really no clear reason why, but that I've ever figured out. But for some reason, I was extremely drawn to that. And I started reading, say, Shonagan and different women writers of pillow books and Tale of Genji. And I just started being taken away by the world that was being created, this very stylized world. And I think part of it might have been also because, you know, in Japan in that period, writing generally was by men and it was in Chinese. And so I think there was something about these women writers who are writing in Japanese that created this real, this freeing space, while at the same time there was, everything was so controlled. And so there is this conflict between giving voice and being controlled. A lot of the pillow books express a lot of sadness because they're no longer the primary wife or their lover is leaving them. And so there's all of this sadness, but the sadness is very stylized even and made very aesthetic. And I was very drawn to that. And so I started working with that in my writing. So I started writing The Tale of Murasaki. And my brother-in-law, Matthew Greenbaum, is a composer, and he asked if he could set it to music, and so he did. And this was a while back. The book was published in 1999. So he said it, and my sister is an opera singer, and so she sang it. I just recently listened to the recording of that piece when it was performed, and oh, it sounded so lovely. And I played it for my sister, and you know, and she heard it, and she was like very happy too. So that was really a nice moment. But when I heard the piece being performed, I started thinking of a narrative that wasn't in the piece originally. And so then I continued working on it. And I created this underlying narrative that other people probably wouldn't necessarily see. It wasn't really the point of it. But for me, it felt like there was this other layer that I felt I wanted to be there, which is a narrative of this contemporary girl that's haunted by this woman from the 11th century Japan, who ended up committing suicide, and she continually haunts this young girl, and this girl wants her to leave, tries to get her to leave, and she won't leave, and finally the ghost agrees to leave, and then the girl feels as though she, after all these years, has become so connected to this ghost that she doesn't want it to leave. And so the reprise dream at the end of the poem, if I can read it, mm-hmm. is, she says she is leaving me, but I hear I am leading you and follow.
I wonder if you could read a poem from this. Also on page 48 to 49, there's a tale of the ancient princess.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be a good one to...
Yes, I could read. And this, I consider... all of this, the tales of Murasaki. Moaning of prayers in morning air. The world cast inside a cicada cage made of bamboo. In search of annunciary, overtones echo home. Cloud echoes cloud. Cloud breaks like bread and steam rises into the stream that flows through a stupa. She no longer welcomed familiar spirits who left messages in layers of dust and in motes, their bon mots. Wild grasses strangled the tamed. Bindweed barred corners.
Your poetry it's a very evocative, but the meaning is not right on the surface by any means. What would you say about this poem if you were to talk about it to our listeners?
As I had said, the pillow books and also Tale of Genji express a lot of yearning and loss, and especially in the female, in the woman's life. And part of it is, this is imperial court life, and so the woman is often in the background. She's behind screens, and she's hidden in clothes and in costume, and so that's the feeling that I'm working with in this work.
So, can you talk a little bit about how do you work with evocativeness? How do you use the sound, the symbols, the images to evoke this life?
Well, one of the things I work with a lot, and I've worked a lot in this particular piece with, is the echo. So you'll see that with moaning of prayers and mourning air. So you have moaning and mourning. You know, it's also alliteration, but the world cast inside a cicada cage. And then it says, overtones echo home, cloud echoes cloud. And so there's this feeling throughout the numbing, humming autumn. And so there are these echoes. The echoes create a sense of mistiness in terms of the sound. And I do that throughout this entire poem. And so I think you really get a feeling, right, of misty. You know, the whole poem, as I said, is about these recurring ghosts and recurring lives. And on one hand, there's this sense of trying to make everything a high aesthetic, and this other sense of the world taking over, of nature taking over. And so that, again, is something that I work with. And so by creating the conflicts, the trying to aestheticize life and nature trying to reclaim itself, and the echoes of trying to escape and find one's lover and not really being able to move and get anywhere. So those kind of conflicts, I think, create a tension. And then, you know, and then also with the lyricism of the language, there's always a beauty, regardless of the tension. And so I think that's a lot of what these women writers were working with, was creating this beauty regardless. And so I think the tension is an interesting tension.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with poet Martine Bellin about her newest collection of poetry. It's both new and old poems. It's called This Amazing Cage of Light. So now there's a very different kind of poem where you move into the American West, the Pioneer West. Calamity Jane, that's on page 97. I wonder if you could read 97 to 99 there and talk about such a different aesthetic, such a different sense that is communicated. And what were you doing here in this poem?
Calamity Jane. Here, the season of manifest destiny and breaded trees. Hungry land, time, backstairs, time. In each of us, an eyewitness. Marthy Cannery by herself, an eyewitness. Born 1852, Missouri, oldest of six brats. Writer until I became an expert rider, unable to ride the not rideable horses, which I spent my early and later life riding. Overland to Virginia City, 5 months journey, hunting the plains or adventuring, shooting and riding way back beyond.
So completely different. Talk about this poem.
Well, I was visiting out west, and I saw this photograph of Calamity Jane, and I'm not sure what it was, but I think she was wearing buckskins and had, I think she had a gun by her side, and she looked so sad and uncomfortable. So I started thinking, who is this woman? And I started reading more about her, and there's so much written about her. And she wrote her own autobiography, and she actually dictated it. She didn't write it because there's no proof that she could read or write. Though there's also a poem about Bellstar in this collection, and Bellstar did read and write and was well educated. So,
and who was Bellstar?
She was also an outlaw in the 19th century, horse thief. And very, very well known in Oklahoma. I actually taught in Oklahoma for a semester, and nobody in Oklahoma would ever wonder who Bellstar is. She was there. She's there, Calamity Jane. We all know Calamity Jane, and they all know Bellstar. So I did more, you know, a lot of research on Bellstar. I mean, on Calamity, on Bellstar also, but on Calamity Jane. And she was really a self-promoter, and these poems from this section of The Vulnerability of Order were poems that I wrote that are somewhat biopics. They're kind of biographies, but they're not researched to be thoroughly true, because a lot of the information is there for self-promotion, to create image, to create mythology. And so I just put all of the mythology in, because these people, characters, are archetypes and mythological goddesses. And so this whole section is on women, American women, who have transgressed ideas of femininity. And Calamity Jane definitely has. And she was self-promoter. She wrote this autobiography for promotion for a dime museum, which is a museum, which is something in the late 19th century that was a popular lowbrow way of entertainment for the masses. P.T. Barnum bought one and it was that kind of thing. And so she was her own show. She was in the Pan American exhibition in 1902, which was like the World's Fair in Buffalo. And she was in comic strips. So she self-promoted herself a lot. And her story is fascinating because it's such a story. I mean, and I think behind the story, it feels to me like there was a sad woman. And so it was fun to visit with her, though.
And even her name, Calamity Jane.
Yeah, there's a story in that, how she got her name, and I write about it in the poem. I could read that. Here it is. Okay, I'll do this. I'll just read this page. The queen with rosemary, potpourri, and cowhands never bedded sober or pennies in her pocket to awaken on a familiar cot and recall a fairy tale. You're a wonderful little woman to have around in times of calamity, says Captain Egan when I save his life, to awaken in an unfamiliar fairy tale.
Hmm. And that's how she got her name?
Well, again, that's what she says. But, you know, there's a sense different people have different stories about her. And even after she was dead, there was someone who came out and said she was the daughter of Wild Bill Hickok and Calamity Jane. And she was, you know, there was a lot of press about these letters that were found after, you know, the death of Calamity Jane. And you know, and apparently that was all false. So it's really hard to know what's true. It's the story of the American West and the Wild West. And
you seem much taken with archetypes, also.
I am. I'm taken with mythology and archetypes, and a lot of that is attributed to my question of who are we? You know, who am I? And the question of identity is something that runs through the whole collection of five books of poetry. And so in all of these collections, in all of these books, in all of these individual collections, I've noticed having them together under the roof of one book, I've noticed that the theme of identity, of the mutability and protean nature of identity is woven throughout all of the work. And so it comes up in questions like the Murasaki poems and in the women archetype, the women mythology poems, and also in more subtle ways where there's a sense of a character that's transforming and mutable at all times.
We're talking with poet Martine Bellin about her new retrospective collection of poetry, This Amazing Cage of Light. Bellin was a fan of Lou Reed's music, and when he died, she wrote an elegy, which is published in This Amazing Cage of Light. I asked her to read it.
The day Lou died. Innumerable people wrote this poem on October 27, 2013, because of Frank O'Hara's The Day Lady Died, written on July 17, 1959, for Billy. And Lou wrote Lady Day, and I was born in January 59. And in his poem, Frank was taking the Long Island Railroad to East Hampton. It took him a little longer to get there from the city than it would have on the day that Lou died. I started this poem on November 19, not October 27, the day Lou died. I'm not proud it took me 3 weeks to start a poem that countless others managed to write on the right day. Nick Flynn's was published in the New Yorker before I typed my first word. Maybe this poem should be called The Day Reed Didn't Die, because he didn't die today, and I wasn't able to write on the day he did, even though I thought about it and knew everyone else was working on theirs. I was too lazy, too sad, too involved in watching Lou YouTubes and surfing Facebook, e-checking what my friends were posting about Lou. It was a mass cyber mourning. Frank died at 40, Billy at 44, Lou died in Springs, which is part of East Hampton. I spend summers in Montauk. Frank, me, and Candy traveling the LIE singing Lou songs. Not really, just in this poem. In his poem, Frank wrote Beginning to Sun, while Lou wrote Beginning to See the Light. Today is November 29, the day after Thanksgiving, and I'm still working on these damn lines, thinking of him, of how the poem lingers on, and his songs, All Alone and Lonely.
I really love that poem because it seems like you're really working through your own process of mourning while you're doing it. It's like the reader is right there with you. Talk about that process that you went through.
Yeah, I love Lou Reed. And he was very important to me when I was younger, when I was a college student. And before college, I was a theater major. And I worked in experimental theater afterwards. I worked with the Iowa Theater Lab. But before I joined the Iowa Theater Lab, my friend and I started our own theater company called The Blood Company. This was in the 70s, late 70s, in New York City on St. Mark's Place in Manhattan. And we did apartment theater. So we'd invite people into our apartment on St. Mark's Place and have them watch our theater. And we used Lou's music a lot. Lou is part of my soundtrack and my creative life. So I was really shaken. Even though I knew he had a liver transplant and that he was sick, I had heard he was getting better, and I was taken and shocked and surprised that he passed like that. So this poem actually does describe what I was going through. And the other thing that I see woven throughout all of these poems, a theme throughout, is connection. And I think the heart of this poem, the Lou Reed poem, is I'm trying to connect. And I'm trying to connect to other people through social media. I'm trying to connect to Lou through his words. All Alone and Lonely are his words. And I'm trying to connect through other poems that seem somehow like his poem. And I'm trying to make it make some kind of sense. Make the whole crazy people dying and not expecting it or even expecting it, and what we're doing when we're making music or writing words, and what is this art, this life that we're in, and trying to see the connections to make it all sense and make sense. And so that's what I was trying to do with this poem.
Hmm. So shifting again, because I find this collection is really very broad in sentiment and in what it evokes. There's the poem on 149, Cat, which I just, of all the poems, I found maybe the most descriptive, or the one that I could just relate to so many different points of it, because I was reading it and looking at my cat and thinking many of the same things. I wonder if you could read it.
Cat. The cat belongs to me. The cat belongs to the house. The cat belongs to the other cat. The cat belongs to itself. The cat belongs to the forest. The cat belongs to the bird and mouse. The cat belongs to the mountain lion. The cat belongs to no one. The cat belongs to nothing. The cat belongs to everyone, everything. The cat has a name that I gave it. Everyone knows the cat's name is not its name. It is my name for the cat. Sometimes the cat refuses to acknowledge this name, and sometimes the cat plays along with the life I've created for the cat. Sometimes the cat pretends that it doesn't live in a realm different from the one that the cat and I live in together. The cat has needs that must be met for the cat to live in my house, though most of the cat's time is spent elsewhere. I invite the cat to live with me so I can perceive some of the elsewhere in which the cat spends much cat time. The cat shares what I can't see by maintaining an existence in my house and by responding to the name I gave the cat. I know there will be a moment in the circuitry of space-time in which the cat will discard the name and forsake my house for good, and will exist only in the fields I cannot see without the cat living in my house. On that day, I might say, the cat has moved full-time into the wild, or I might say, meow meow has run away.
It's just a perfect poem about a cat. Talk about archetype, and yet really captures that sense of the how cats allow us to be part of their world by being part of ours. We're talking with Martine Bellin, poet and teacher, also Zen practitioner, about her newest collection. It's called This Amazing Cage of Light. It's a collection of poetry from five of her collections, including new poems. And finally, could you tell me, what's poetry for you?
That's, you know, yeah, I think about that. I mean, for me, poetry, it started, for me personally, it started when I was very young as a place of comfort. And now it's a place of play and engagement, and it's a place that has, like, that takes me. I feel as though, it's funny, the longer I have been writing, and I think the better my chops get, the more I feel that I'm able to let poetry, which is a source, like a wave, take me. And I feel as though if I'm writing regularly, or, well, not always regularly, but if I'm writing fairly regularly, I have the chops to shape it. But I feel like it takes me more than I take it. And I think the poet does often live in the margins. It's really in the margins, in the transitions between, you know, here in East Hampton, you know, between sand and water, that, you know, between right here in this interview, between the speaker and the listener, and the, you know, it's those transitions really that the synergy and energy of poetry exists, I mean, or life exists, where there's something there that we can kind of mine with language, and things can get lost there, and, you know, things can fall between the cracks, but things can also be found there. A lot of things are found in those cracks. A lot of things are lost and a lot of things are found. So yeah, it's like going and looking into those cracks and what has been lost.
Well, it's a wonderful collection. Martine Bellin, thank you so much for talking with us here about your poetry and your work and about life. The collection is This Amazing Cage of Light.
Thank you very much, Francesca. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Poet Martine Bellin. This Amazing Cage of Light is out from Spuyten Duyvil Press. Go to writersvoice.net to read the poem Cat and to hear a clip from the opera based on Bellin's poetry cycle, The Tale of Murasaki. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.